This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, and today I'm speaking with Michael Brewers, author of the book Napoleon, The Decline and Fall of an Empire, 1811 to 1821. Michael, welcome back to the New Books Network.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on the show.
No problem.
I was wondering, for some of our listeners who may not have heard the previous podcast that we've done, if you could tell them something about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor emeritus now. Sadly, I retired from my job at Oxford, my chair at Oxford, last year. I was professor of Western European history there for 19 years. Before that, I taught at a couple of universities in the UK and in the United States. And I happen to have been born in the United States, actually, in Connecticut. But I'm Irish. I was largely brought up in Ireland. And I'm an Oxford person, really. I suppose that's about
it. Sounds like quite good. Sorry, go ahead.
Which is always my supervisor, so I'm very proud of that association.
So what led you to undertake a multi-volume biography of Napoleon Bonaparte? Because it's such a daunting task on so many levels. What led you to embrace the challenge?
Two things, really, because I was in the middle of another project, which I hope I'm going to get back to in the next year or so. But first of all, I was approached. That we were having a lot of anniversaries, bicentenaries and things. There was a flood of lives of Napoleon. And the two publishers involved in this one wanted their own. And I was approached by them. The hook, though, that made me decide to do it was the production by the Fondation Napoléon in Paris, Thierry Lance's team, of this incredible new correspondant général of Napoleon. You know, his correspondence was first brought out by his nephew, Napoleon III, in the 1850s and 60s, and it's something that sort of was there and wasn't there, wasn't really satisfactory. A professional historian, the nephew editing the uncle's stuff wasn't the best recipe for objectivity. They didn't have the research tools in those days we have now. Thierry Lawrence and the Fondation were producing this marvelous thing that's almost four times now as large as the original 3.5. And I was going to be the first in the field with that if I took this on. So I jumped at it. It was going to be possibly not different, possibly different. It was certainly going to be better informed than anybody else.
I was going to say, one of the things that really fascinated me was, I mean, given the scope of that project and the sheer amount of information that there's available on Napoleon, how you were able to really, for lack of a better word, tame it all, because there's just so much out there available about him. And the correspondence just to add to that, and yet your volume can really bog down in details. You're always able to kind of keep a pace going, and you don't lose the forest for the trees, so to speak.
Well, that's kind of you to say, and I'm glad you think that. Some readers do. Some readers do think I get lost. It's rather hard not to, because there's an awful lot there. I developed a way of working the correspondence, which may or may not be satisfactory, but I felt this was the best way to try to handle it. In that, on the one hand, you trace his correspondence with a person over certain periods. On the other, you focus on a certain period. You focus on a certain number of days, weeks, whatever, and just read everything. And then, as I say, there are people you trace. Having said that, I'll throw it in the caveat, It's one of these things. It's like walking around the open shelves of a great library and you always read the book that was beside the one you went to borrow. Like that. You know, you're reading what you're supposed to read, and then you look over and think, hey, that's interesting. I didn't know that. There's all that going on, and that is helped. Again, I have to go back to it by the incredible, assiduous research aid that Lotz has provided, his superb index to the letters, to the people. You can trace that really well. When it's chronological, you really have to take that on yourself and decide, this is the crisis point. These are the dates that matter. I'm going in there. But this new version of the correspondence is really the researcher's friend, you know, and it's never going to be exhaustive. It's never going to be definitive, because there is simply so much of value in there, and it's something that we'll all have to use from now on. But I was very fortunate and very grateful to be the first person in there who could write an entire biography that could refer to it. Because my great friend and rival, Philip Dwyer, of course, he went into the field with a 3-volume Life of Napoleon. It's very different from mine. We're very different historians. But the volume one came out, and a lot of his volume two, before the stuff was published. And indeed, I felt towards the end of the project, I felt a bit like the script writers for Game of Thrones, who desperately Martin to produce the goods, and he wasn't. And I just about made it. You know, I sort of was kind of in a race for the couple of volumes. Before I do it, and I was sort of, you know, on the phone to the thousands of people. That's you know, couldn't you just sneak me the rushes? You know, couldn't I just see? No, but you know, and here's a free copy anyway. You know, we sent a free copy, by FedEx. You know, so I did have it all in the end.
Oh wow, that's fantastic! It's good to know that that's how you can get free copies of expensive books.
A couple of them, yeah, yeah. They were terrific. They're terrific people, and I think the whole world of the Napoleonic scholarship owes them a massive debt. And if there's anything that sets that book apart, my books apart, I think it's that. And it's great to see so many people using it. It's great to see it being put online. You know, they've got a few volumes of it online now. It's going to all be online at some point in the future. You know, it's tremendous. It's absolutely tremendous. But I'm retired now. But I envy future research students, and I envy their supervisors even more. And all of the correspondence is online. You know, well, just open up your computer and click. You know, I couldn't do that with my folks. You know, it's tremendous. But that's what spurred me to do it, because I never really saw myself as a biographer until then. Of course, the first volume didn't come out until I was 60, and my work had been very different. But that's shown me a whole new path, and I think the next book might be about another biography. I don't know.
Oh, really? Let's turn to the book itself and where you open, because you begin in 1811, and you provide us with a picture of Napoleon at that point in his life, and also you give us a overview of his empire. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain what, you know, where Napoleon was at that point in his life, and what it was that he was in charge of. And the challenges he was facing at that point in his career.
Yeah, well, when I started to write that, when I chose the dates I did, I was very influenced by Edward Gibbon, His Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which I read when I was a schoolboy. I started to read it, and my classics master, my Latin master, always used to say that I was bitten by Gibbon in the impressionable age. And you know, the thing is, that's where it came from. It came quite naturally to me, but it does take some explaining. I started when, on the face of it, Napoleon is at his peak. He's got everything going for him. He's got over the trauma of divorcing Josephine. He's remarried Marie-Louise. He's finally, you know, now has the much wished for, prayed for heir. Legitimate heir. He's got a son, you know, he's got to look forward to. And his empire, if you look at it on paper, is at its height. France, the parts of Europe that were annexed directly to France and governed from Paris as parts of France, numbered over 120 departments. Hamburg was a French town. Bremen was a French town. Rome was a French town. You know, this is unbelievable when you think about it. All these places, Munster was a French town. Plus the satellite kingdoms under his siblings, some of which, like Holland, have been abolished and absorbed into the empire. Some of which, like Naples, Westphalia in Germany, Spain, are still there, just about. And he is, on paper at least, allies with Prussia and Austria. He's forced them into an alliance. If you look at this and you gulp, and indeed, if you were, well, Alexander the First, the Russian Tsar, the British government, the Austrians, the Prussians, they all gulped. That's why the Prussians and the Austrians went along with him and became his allies, because they just didn't see how the guy could be beaten. You know, he looks like this is it. And yet, you know, 3 years later, it's gone. And so inevitably, if you're an historian trained in a certain way like me, you start to probe for the weaknesses. If you take it in Gibbon at a very early impressionable stage when I was a teenager, you start to look under this at the weaknesses. Gibbon starts off the decline of fall of the Roman Empire with Augustus, Rome's Silver Age. You know, I remember picking it up when I was a teenager, around about 15, and thinking, wait a minute, I'm reading the wrong book here. You know, there's no barbarian invasions for another three volumes or something. What's going on? You know, and it's a bit like that. I mean, you look at the size of the empire, it looks impregnable. But when you look at it in many ways, it's actually a confession of weakness. He's trying to defeat the British through economic warfare and blockade. The only way he can do it is to annex the whole of the North Sea coast to France, to annex most of northwestern Italy to France, to put his brother in charge of Spain because Spain won't force the blockade or can't, to try and force the Russian Tsar into an entente, to help him with the blockade again. All of that is fraying very badly. He has to do that because he's frustrated. He just can't win. He just cannot break the British through economic warfare. He looks like he might in 1811-12. He looks like he might, you know, but underneath, it fails. And he's got himself into what imperialist historians now call imperial overstretch. He can't control this. He can't handle it. His relationship with Russia is very tense and going to collapse because he's extended to Poland and created the Duchy of Warsaw, which creates intractable tensions between them. The Russians cannot go into the blockade. They depend on British trade too much for their raw materials. He's got a war in Spain that he is actually winning. Not a lot of people want to admit that, but especially in this country. But he is actually doing better in Spain than you could ever dream of in 1811. But he cannot drive the British out. He can contain them. All of this is going on. The son, having the son, Napoleon Francis, looks, you know, this is what he's been afraid of for so long, that it's all very Roman. You know, when he dies, the empire will fall apart. It's like Alexander the Great, nowhere. The generals will fall out among themselves. He says, now the heir should solve that, except for something that, again, I felt I had to emphasize. He also knows he's an ill man. And that little boy is barely out of, you know, he's only born in 1811, and Napoleon has to think to himself, I haven't got long left. And he didn't. He only had 10 more years to live. It's going to be a long regency. And regencies are bad news, especially in France. They are bad, bad news. You know, things have to be settled. He has to be as secure on that throne as I can make him. And this leads him into all sorts of problems. So, you know, all the glitter is just not gold.
One of the things that I was taking from your description of those years, this goes to what you were just saying about his longevity. It's really the sense of him as a middle-aged man trying to still be the man he was in his youth, and you see that with the invasion of Russia that he launches in 1812, which is that he wants to undertake this grand campaign. It struck me as I was reading about how it seems like it was the tool in his toolkit that he was most comfortable with using. But he also recognizes that he can't, you know, he's not the man of 1796 or 1805 anymore. You describe a couple points how he has to get off the horse and get in the carriage because he doesn't have that stamina that he had in his youth. And so there is that sense that I didn't really fully appreciate until I read the book, of the urgency in terms of defeating Russia, that he couldn't afford to negotiate. He really had to break Russia, and that he was trying the only way that he knew how, which was on the battlefield, destroying the army, and therefore forcing Alexander to submit.
Yeah, I think digging deep into the correspondence and also into other reliable sources, reliable memoirs. The two people he really confides in here are Cambaceres, who's always his number two, his de facto regent when he's away, the guy who framed the civil code, the Code of Napoleon. I mean, this is the guy he trusts with his life. And Colin Cour, who's his foreign minister for a time, was his minister, his ambassador to St. Petersburg just before the Russian conflict began. And from several sources you draw together, you know, he knows he's ill. As you say, he's not the man of 1805. He knows that. He's known it really from about 1809, when he was desperately ill, the Bagram campaign against Austria, and actually says to Josephine, who he's still married to at the time, you know, you've heard I've not been well, probably through the rumor mill. Well, the rumor mill was right, but I'm okay now. He never, ever says to her or to his mother, I've been ill. You know, he'll say to his brother Joseph, I've been ill. Now, look, don't tell mom, don't tell, you know. But he says to them in 1811, because Cambaceres says to him, look, you know, this is not a good idea. Napoleon can always listen to criticism. You know, he's not an unreasonable person. He's not hysterical or anything. He's not a megalomaniac. That you, this is not a good idea, boss. Everybody calls him boss. Everybody calls him chef. It is a good idea. You're going to be a long, long way from Paris. Long, long way from here. This is not a good idea. I mean, I'll hold the fort as best I can, but this is not a good idea. You know what happens to people when they invade Russia. Charles XII in Sweden, he invaded Russia. Look what happened to him. He lost everything. It's not a good idea, pal. You've never done anything like this. Kodigur says the same. You know, look, they're more organized than you think. You know they're organized, but you don't know how they're organized. Well, I'm telling you, you're going to have trouble. This is not like any campaign you fought. Napoleon doesn't throw them out of the room and shout at them and talk about, you know, start calling them defeatists or whatever. He says to them quite calmly, I know all that, but look, A, I'm ill. B, the boy is very young. We've got to have as peaceful a regency as we can. Alexander, for a whole number of reasons, can no longer be trusted and regarded as a friend. He was more right about that than he knew. Alexander wanted to invade Poland and Germany early in 1811, and his military convinced him that it wasn't on because the Poles would not cooperate. They were pro-Napoleon. And he's the only one with an army left in Europe that is capable of defeating us. And so he's got to be taken on and sorted out. If we manage to defeat that army in one big battle, which is always how he works, there's nothing new about that, then things shall be settled at least long enough for my son to come of their age, and I've got to do it. Literally, this is what he says to Cambaceres. I've got to do it while I can still get in the saddle. That's one of those ringing phrases I have ever read. While I can still get in the saddle. Yep, he knows. And that's what's pushing him. You know, that, I think, is the main driving force. It's why I have to do it now. It's why I can't prevaricate. What he doesn't know is how ready to strike Alexander was. And was, you know, just thwarted by other circumstances. Alexander was going to start a hostile war, an offensive war. He didn't. He started preparing for a defensive one pretty quickly, switched to offense to defense remarkably quickly. But that's why he feels he has to do it. You know, he can't see another way out because of his own circumstances. I'm glad I only took this on when I myself was older. Because I'm not than I was 10 years ago. You know, time is short. I can appreciate that better now than I would have if I'd started writing it with. I began it when I was, you know, in my mid-50s. And I was writing that when I was in my mid-60s. And I'm glad, because if I'd started it 20 years ago, I wouldn't have appreciated that as much as I do now.
So, but of course, the problem is that while Alexander has the army, he also is smart enough not to accommodate Napoleon. And Alexander really emerges in your book as the person who, more than any other single one, brings about Napoleon's defeat during this 3-year period. He's not going to play Napoleon's game. He draws Russia in, and you make it clear. I mean, the campaign's falling apart long before you get to Moscow and the winter. It goes wrong from the snap.
Oh, it does. Most of the horses. Napoleon himself came back, and immediately created the myth that he had to, for his own credibility, that it was the winter that killed us boys. The weather defeated me. It was bad planning and bad timing. He always puts his hand up and says, okay, it was bad planning and bad timing and all that. It was the retreat that did for me the winter. It was an early winter, but maybe I should have gone out earlier. Okay, I'm guilty of that, but that's what did for me, and you can't control the weather. In fact, no. It didn't help. Most of the horses, for example, die on the way in because he goes in a sense too early. He can't carry enough fodder for his cavalry. And what are they doing? They're eating raw, fresh, green grass that gives them stomach ulcers, and they all keel over and die. It's horrendous if you're an animal lover. They're dead before he gets to Moscow. They're dead before he fights Borodino, most of them. And of course, they can never be replaced. He goes in with the most magnificent cavalry in the world. It comes out with nothing. Whereas Alexander is building cavalry behind him all the time. The whole thing falls apart. This is gruesomely familiar when you think about what's going on in the Ukraine. It was eerie watching that, considering I just finished that chapter. The mud that gets stuck in the mud. He brings in, it's all about Bignus 1812. It's shock and awe. These huge wagons pulled by teams and teams of oxen that can carry all this gear, all the logistics the army needs, all the supplies, pulling the big guns, whatever. And the Russian roads are so primitive, unpaved, that they just can't carry the weight. It's all falling apart. Troops lagging behind, getting ill, loss of men on the march, even more so than in battle. There's the first big battle is well into the campaign in Smolensk. And the big losses have already been incurred. Obviously, the last stages of the retreat in the depths of winter are horrendous. And the suffering was horrendous for both armies. But the losses were not as big as the going in, as the advance. It's all fallen apart from the beginning. It really, really is.
I was going to add that one of the things you do in the book that I really like was how you subtly call back to that when you're describing the War of the Sixth Coalition, the war that is launched in the aftermath of Napoleon's failure. When you talk about how he goes back into battle against the Russians and the Prussians, and he wins, but he no longer has the ability to turn those victories into triumphs, how he no longer has the cavalry to completely cut off his enemy and totally demolish their armies. And so he's feeling that loss, that army that once sacrificed in Russia, he can't get back no matter how hard he tries. You describe that the efforts that he undertakes to do so are formidable.
Well, they are. I mean, the trying to rebuild the cavalry in the end proves impossible. And it's also laughable, because he sends out these desperate appeals. I mean, it is more or less these things, you got in Russia, in the Soviet Union in World War II, each factory, adopt a tank. It's your tank. Contribute to it. Pay for it. And your factory, your unit can have a tank. And it's a bit like that. Every department contributes so many horses. What do they do? I mean, sometimes they'll cough up the money. Sometimes, all right, we'll contribute horses. And what do you get? You get Dob on the cart horse. You get some suede back thing. You get My Little Pony. What do you do? Well, I gave my daughter's pony, because that's the only horse I have. Anything, And you see the geography in it within the empire, particularly within France, the departments that are still within, the parts of France that are still within the departments of the internal administrative units of France, are still within, they do their best. The departments that are largely lukewarm about him or even really opposed to him at heart do next to nothing, but he cannot scrape horses together. His only real trump card there is he pulls cavalry units out of Spain. The army in Spain becomes his treasure trove. Now, that's weakening the Spanish front. But it is, you know, that is where he gets what hope he has. Because he does, he says, you were saying, I mean, in the Saxon campaign, the first major battles of Dresden, he wins it. He wins two other engagements, smaller ones, Bautzen and Lützen. He cannot follow any of those up because there's no cavalry to pursue. And, you know, the Allies at first are very discouraged. I mean, those are largely fought by the Prussians with a bit of Russian backup. And they're getting pretty discouraged. You know, they've been beaten in the field. But then, like, well, where is he? Well, he's not coming. Why? Because he hasn't got any horses. You know, and Alexander's sitting there thinking, that's all right, fellas, I've got plenty of horses. You know, I've got the steppe ponies, who are the old world's equivalent of the American Mustang. You know, I'll just go round some up. You know, send the Cossacks out and tell them to round up some more steppe ponies for me. And, you know, everybody knows how to ride out there. We all know how to ride. Come on. And he can raise cavalry units out of nothing. But in his desperation, even, look, think about it. He's won at Dresden, and it's a heroic victory. It's largely a French army that fights Dresden, unlike Russia, which was called the Army of the 22 Nations, which was composite from all over Europe, all over his empire. Dresden is by and large a French army, mixture of hardened veterans and a large number of raw recruits who fight very well. And you take great heart from that, but you can't follow it up.
The exhaustion that France is feeling about those campaigns is so evident when he's going into exile. You describe how he's being transported to Elba. And he has these French subjects as people who are just furious with him about it. You get the impression that he really that they were done with him, and yet he goes to Elba and he comes back. And I was thinking about all of the previous accounts I've read, which make it seem like, you know, they loved him, they missed him, and you make it clear that a lot of France was much more ambivalent about Napoleon and by that point, not to mention and his return, than sometimes Napoleon himself, of course, would care to admit.
I think ambivalence the word, Mark, and I think that was, I really do think that was something that needed to be said pretty emphatically. When he comes back, you've got to remember a whole history of this. It doesn't just start with Napoleon taking power in 1799. This goes right back to the French Revolution. You know, the lived experience is 10 years of revolution followed by Napoleon and how many years of war. And when he reappears, although people are fed up with him, they want rid of him, as you say, they want done with him, there is also this sense that runs very deep in French society. Hedge your bets. We don't know what's going to happen. You know, we might want rid of them, but we might be stuck with them again. Who's to say what could happen? Who knows what can happen? Everything that can happen has happened. It could happen again. It's the only way I can explain it. Right. So they sit tight. Okay, we support whoever's in Paris. We wait for the word to come and we say, yes, we're with you. Because who knows? There are certain parts of French society that are absolutely against Napoleon, and it shows. Over most of the South and the West, they opposed the revolution. They've always opposed Napoleon. They've been suppressed, but they've never been won over. They take to the field against him. That's part of the reason, if you even look at the way he marches to Paris, but the first stage of it, when he's going through the South, when he's going through Provence and places like that, I mean, I've driven that road. I hasten to say, when I was much, much younger, my wife and I drove that road. I drove that road many years ago. And you're practically on the goat's paths if you follow the line. You know, if you follow the route of the march, you're right up the nails on these hairpin bends. You know, I mean, I needed a stiff Napoleon brandy after a couple of days of that. Honestly, it was scary. And what is he doing? He's keeping out of the way because that part of France is deeply hostile to it. He knows he could be stopped. And he's more, it's not a triumphal march, it's evasive. When he gets further north into the big garrison towns, into places like Burgundy and the Champagne that have always supported the revolution, always supported him, because they see him as the revolution, he's fine, he's out in the open, he's going to do it. And that's part of the reason when he gets that far, why the Bourbons collapse, why they run. Because they don't know what's going to happen. They've been overthrown once before, they'll be overthrown again. You know, better to scamper to safety in Belgium and regroup, you know, with the British and the Prussians around them to fight another day, because the lived experience is one is complete uncertainty. But when Napoleon gets to Paris and takes over, he's not sitting on top of a country that loves him. It's a country that divides between those who hate him, the large silent majority who are staying silent, just going to sit it out, and his support, which largely comes from inside the establishment, from the army, large swathes of the army, from the civil service, from those parts of France, those regions of France that were always pro-revolutionary and did not like the Bourbons. They might have been prepared to accept them in 1814, but haven't had them back. They immediately become suspicious. They'll support Napoleon because he has the wit in 1815 to win them over by saying, I'm returning to the values of the revolution. By doing that, he writes off a huge part of France and he undoes his own cherished policy, which he's taken on from the beginning. The French words are the best, Rouaillement and amalgam, amalgamation and rallying, trying to win people from all sides and stripes of opinion over to him, or at least convince them to accept, you know, and he betrays that in 1815. He has to, but he does.
Go ahead.
It's a very tense time.
Well, you appreciate the time you've taken to speak with us, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm taking a bit of a breather, but just retired. I'm desperately trying to write an article and a couple of conference papers. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm pretty desperate because the deadline's in about 7 weeks. But I've been approached about possibly writing a life of Murat, which I think would be Napoleon's cavalry commander, which I think would be fun. He's a colorful guy. I have a long-term project I've got to get back to called Napoleonic Civilization, which is about the kind of ideology and actually downright ethnic prejudices that underpin a lot of the empire. I broke off doing that to write the biography. But Murat was an idea that was put to me over a good lunch by a publisher and an agent, and it sounds like fun. So maybe that.
Those both sound like fantastic projects. I wish you the best of luck with them. Michael, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, and you too. Thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.